soul.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is there?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CQT 90.3 FM. We are 6 days into the month of January. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CQT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, we have a panel of participants from the Why Us campaign, a group that seeks to critique the addition of Bill C-7, which is an amendment to the Assisted Dying Act. Bill C-7 explicitly targets those with disabilities. All that, plus your weekly music pick, right here on CQT 90.3 FM. You're listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at cked.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT.
This is Derek Singer, stay-at-home dad and pre-COVID comedian. I'm sorry, I'm eating a hot turkey sandwich. Again. I made tons for the holidays. I'll probably still be eating turkey till Valentine's Day. But it's time we talk about our resolutions. Please, stay at home and limit your contacts. Let's protect each other. And if anyone has a recipe that calls for 17 pounds of leftover turkey, I really need that. Like, really. Let's keep our spirits up.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. Up this hour is an interview with Kevin Penny, Dr. Jeff Preston, and Aaron Clark from the YS campaign. YS is a campaign in response to Bill C-7, which seeks to amend the current Assisted Dying Act by including non-foreseeable death clause, which explicitly targets disabled people. We would like to preface this piece with the trigger warning on suicide. So, hi everyone, welcome to the show. Would you guys mind introducing yourself to the audience?
I'm Erin, my pronouns are she, her. I am an author and disabled.
Sure, my name's Kevin, I go as he, him, and I'm a person with a disability living in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and I've just been an advocate for a while and I'm just kind of new to this campaign and kind of got on board and I'm looking forward to where we can take it.
My name is Dr. Jeff Preston. I'm an assistant professor at King's University College here in London, Ontario. I work in the world of disability studies. And I first got involved in this several years ago with another online campaign called Project Value, which has since kind of evolved into the YS campaign. Oh, and he, him.
So we're here to talk about Bill C-7. So Bill C-7 is an act to expand medical assisted dying within Canada. The original act, which was Bill C-14, was passed in 2016, which legalized euthanasia within Canada. What did the original act establish?
Bill C-14 was really the first attempt by the federal government to put forward a medical assistance in dying legislation, which most importantly for disability rights advocates, had a provision written within it that those who were going to be applying for medical assistance in dying had to fall within a series of criteria. And one of those criteria was this provision that death had to be in, quote, the foreseeable future, that they were on a trajectory toward end of life. This was seen as an important safety mechanism built with Bill C-14, with the desire to ensure that people were not opting out of life simply because things were very difficult, simply because they were having trouble accessing services or medical care, but rather that this was really to prevent suffering in end-of-life situations. That, of course, has since been overturned as a result of a court case in the Superior Court of Quebec. And that's really what brings us to Bill C-7, which is an attempt to try and change Bill C-14 to better align with the court findings.
Would you be able to elaborate on the Superior Court's decision in Quebec to overturn that?
Yeah, so the Superior Court, again, summarizing in a couple words, essentially found that the not reasonably foreseeable death clause was not constitutional, that it was an unfair burden placing on certain people, that there were those who should qualify for MAID who were not able to as a result of that provision. And so as a result, it was struck down. And it was then up to the federal government to either appeal that decision up to the Supreme Court or to harmonize the law to fall in line. The federal government at that time decided not to appeal, which meant that the clock was then ticking for them to amend C-14 to align with that, which largely meant removing the reasonably foreseeable death clause.
They were removing the reasonably foreseeable death clause only for specific people. It specifies who is exempt from reasonably foreseeable death, as opposed to it just being removed for every Canadian.
Would you be able to elaborate on who they specify?
There's a very specific wording. Illness conditions, and I can't remember the third.
Disease,
that's it. People with disabilities and chronic illnesses, basically, is who that covers.
This is building off of the original Bill C-14, which defined that one of the metrics to allow you to qualify for medical assistance in dying is that you had to have essentially like a medical justification for wanting to end life. And so by removing this foreseeable death clause, it does not open up MAID to everyone, but rather it opens up MAID to those who have this condition category, but don't necessarily have the foreseeable death clause.
And what does this new phrasing mean for people with disabilities?
I think that's a really, really big question.
Yeah.
A really, really big question, because I think that to understand why there is a growing number of people with disabilities that are really upset about this legislative change, you need to take a little bit of a step back. Because I think the reason we are where we are today right now is in part because of this fundamental problem, which is that there are a lot of people who just don't understand what it's like to have a disability because they themselves have never experienced it firsthand. Perhaps they've even never had a family member or maybe even never met anybody with a disability. And the result is that we have essentially two versions of reality that are running side by side. We have the sort of fantasized belief of what it's like to be disabled and the experiences of disabled people, which is a life of suffering, a life of difficulty, a life of strife, a life of being a burden on everyone around you. And then there's the more complicated reality of disability, which is that experiences of disability are not monolithic in nature. They are wildly diverse not just in terms of you know, from person to person, but from region to region, from social economic status to others, racial status, all of the intersections fundamentally changes people's interactions and experiences of disability. And ultimately, what a lot of people within the world of the academy, people like myself, and I think also my friends and colleagues here on the call, many people start to realize the longer you live with disability, the longer you realize that some of the most disabling factors are not actually those found within your body, that I am not disabled by muscular dystrophy, but I am disabled by a country that never expected or never desired people with muscular dystrophy to be full citizens within this country. Mm-hmm. So why Bill C-7 is upsetting or worrisome or troublesome, the concern ultimately is that this option offers a fast track to death for a population who we have been essentially setting up for death for as long as we have lived.
I think that it also puts a lot of faith in the medical community to draw very particular lines, you know, like who's determining what intolerable suffering entails. And, you know, even in like the disabled experience, there's the elements of our lives that are an, you know, an interaction with the medical community, with doctors and healthcare providers. And in those experiences, often what's reflected back to us is even those who are considered the experts of our conditions and of our bodies often fail to have any frame of reference for what our lives are actually like. You know, ableism is not taught to medical professionals. They're not given the context for what, you know, it's like to take disability out of the medical context and into the world. And now this bill is saying these people with no training and no, you know, like specific education around this are suddenly going to be able to make a decision about what lives are worth living when all of their training up until the moment the bill passes has been about not judging what lives are worth living, you know, and saving and supporting as medicine allows, right? So the question that it brings up for me is, where is this information coming from, if not from disabled people? If you have politicians crafting bills that have never been through a process of consulting with the disabled community, where are they getting these ideas about what suffering is for us and what its cause is and how we live with our limits, but also with the stigma and the discrimination and like not just our physical limits, but the social limits put on us? Where are they getting this information from? Where is this confidence that they've crafted this comprehensive and also safe bill when there's no access to that part of the disabled experience that's purely medicalized? And even within that, there are limits to what the medical professionals understand. So there's just this complete lack of the appropriate and necessary expertise in the bill itself.
My concern too, and Jeff and them said it was fast-tracked and kind of pushed through and people were really suffering. And I didn't know anything about this, but that's my big concern, I think. And what I really kind of gravitated towards making a change is that the sample size of what they took of disability and suffering, what they called, was so small compared to the vast amount of individuals.
It was two people.
So many different differences out there that our stories and so many other thousands of stories that are out there that were not suffering. So that's really what brought me on board and got me concerned, is the sample size. And this is really not what people with disabilities want. And it's a slippery slope, and it should be interesting to see how it moves forward.
I think Kevin also makes like a really interesting point, because the bill names us, like it calls us out. Mm-hmm. We didn't go looking for this. It just like, we're there in print. And, you know, the rhetoric in the House of Commons when they were debating the bill from those who like support it was just about how like it's for these people. It's for, you know, this is for them. But the second we were like, but we don't want it, we were shut out of the conversation. And so it begs the question, who is it actually for? You know, like who really thinks that, like who is this really satisfying? What need is this really filling? Because it's not filling the needs we're very clear about having. And because then, you know, when we say that's not actually what we want is all of this stuff over here instead, that kind of gets like, no, but you're missing the point. And it just strikes me as very odd that the disabled community, especially the like organizations defending disability rights who are unanimously against it, were not at the front of a conversation about the context that disability in Canada like occurs in.
And Erin, you mentioned that the creation of this bill was just a handful of people. Would you be able to elaborate on the history of the creation of this bill?
What I meant, Kevin was saying how it was based on a very few number of people. And what I meant is that the bill, the amendment, like Bill C-7, mm-hmm. is based on a case, one in a court, that had two applicants, two people, two disabled citizens, are the basis of a bill that would impact all of the people with disabilities in Canada. That's mm-hmm. like, that was their sample size of case studies. These two people feel this way about their disability and about their suffering. And the bill was extrapolated from that. And that's essentially it, which is so obviously inadequate, you know?
And are there any other aspects of Bill C-7 that directly target people with disabilities? Like, are there any particular phrasings or wordings that would disproportionately affect disabled people versus abled people?
Not exactly. Insofar as really all Bill C-7 is doing is targeting that reasonable foreseeable death clause. And so I think what can be really difficult from a media perspective for, you know, headline news, for newspapers, for radio shows, even just like this, even, is that there is a nuance and complexity to the impacts of C-7 that are not drawn out explicitly within the bill itself, right? BC-7 is pitched as being all about personal choice. That they say, you know, we're not forcing anybody to receive euthanasia. We're merely allowing people to make the right decision, which generally speaking, politically speaking, ideologically speaking, I am very much in favor of personal choice. I think the disabled population for far too long have had decisions made for them by experts as opposed to being given the ability to choose. But what Bill C-7 doesn't address or doesn't even start to get into is the absolute complexity of making such a choice. It presumes that the decision people are making is between either enduring tremendous bodily anguish and suffering or having a, quote, merciful death. But as we have seen time and again throughout history, disabled populations have been both overtly and very covertly targeted for elimination. And what Bill C-7 does is it opens up the door, it fast tracks the ability for people to opt out. So then we're left with an even more urgent question. If the government is going to do this much to allow for us to die, what steps is the federal government going to do to actually enable us to live? Because that is found nowhere within Bill C-7.
Well, and something that, you know, Jeff said about this being about choice and supporting our right to choose, and the word autonomy has been thrown around a lot. And we currently struggle to exercise agency on a daily basis, and not because things are difficult for us physically, but because people in authority and organizations and systems actively prohibit us from accessing education and from accessing employment. And, you know, there are processes in place that make it incredibly difficult to access housing equipment that we need that enables us to be independent, and access to the medication that would, you know, in some cases stabilize people's health conditions. And a lot of it, I think, relates to what Jeff was saying about earlier, about there's a fantasy about what disability is in the minds of people who are non-disabled. And it was crafted by non-disabled people. And it's potent. It's every metaphor in every movie since the beginning of movies, and then storytelling before that. And you know, a thing that comes up about that a lot is how it objectifies our experience so completely that the individual experience, us as people, is completely erased. And, you know, I'll have the experience of meeting somebody who's never really interacted with a disabled person before. All they have is the ideas in their head of what that should look like and what that must mean for me. And the conversation or the interaction will start right off the bat with, oh my God, I could never, you know, like, it's so amazing that you're out, or, you know, it's so good for me to see you here, because if this was me, I could never live this way. I would rather die than live this way. And these are people I don't know that I've not encouraged an interaction with. I'm grabbing my coffee at the Starbucks, or I'm buying some, you know, groceries, and they're having this moment where what they expected disability to look like doesn't match what they're experiencing or seeing of me in public going about my day-to-day life. And instead of that suggesting that they might be wrong about that perception, or that that entire idea and fantasy of disability might not apply, they assume that there's something like otherworldly special about me. I mean, people will get on their knees and cry because I have crossed a street by myself. It's not proportional to what I'm actually, like, my actual function in the world. And I think the intensity that people have to the fantasy of disability is part of the issue for us in the bill. And that seems very abstract. I realize that, like, we're talking about a piece of legislation that's very concrete. They want to pass it into a law that amends the criminal code, right? Like, that's significant to me. But I think that the reason why it's been so difficult to have a conversation about it in that environment, in the House of Commons, where that the power is, mm-hmm. is because they're all part of that fantasy. They're using an image of this suffering disabled person that they created, and then they're sharing it amongst each other and don't want to hear that that doesn't actually fit for a large majority of disabled people and their lived experience.
Well, I think to some way, I think, Aaron, you're right on there, but I think I've heard this many times and I kind of buy into it now, is our disabilities aren't really what disables us. It's our environment and the people around us. So it's more disabling than anything else. And I see that in so many ways, like employment, education, housing. If you don't give people basic needs, how do you expect them to be productive members of society and live a good life? But if their environment is creating barriers to all these things and they have to fight even though to even get in the door, that's what's disabling. And your life would be pretty freaking shitty if that was the case. Luckily, I don't have that situation. I consider myself maybe privileged, but I've got those supports in place and I have those and I know what my life is. But I see other individuals who do not and have to fight for $25 more dollars a month for something, a high fiber diet, and they get that denied. But what that means to people is huge. Like, that could, and it's just, well, you don't need that. So it's our society, I think, in general, who are disabling and not disability itself. Because, yeah, I have a C4 spinal cord injury. I'm paralyzed from the chest down. But I have a damn good life that I want to continue to live and prosper and explore and so it's really heartening that, like, Aaron and Jeff, and we've all kind of pushed forward that it's society that are making these decisions or these assumptions on our behalf. And I'm so glad YRYS campaign really got out there quickly and got feedback from the people who this will affect. Yeah, to sum it up, I think our society is more disabling than our disabilities ourselves.
Well, and Kevin, you make a really good point about how much at the mercy our well-being is at some fairly arbitrary decision-making processes. Like, not getting access to things that we need means that even when we're very privileged, there's also an edge of vulnerability that, like, if you can't afford to pay for your wheelchair or your medicine or your home support care yourself, the government, who would be tasked with the authority to assess whether or not you qualified for death, are the same people who are assessing whether or not you can get access to those things.
I think a friend of mine summed it up really good, is that when it comes to disability, everyone still uses the medical model.
Yeah.
And it sums it up pretty good, because we're still seen as sick or suffering. It's a medical model, and we're not wanting to be seen as a medical model. But all those programs, whether it's community services or health, are all still under the medical philosophy of, okay, keep these person alive or give them chance to prosper. It's just really unfortunate. I see it a lot within our province here in Nova Scotia, specifically around technology and how it's not seen how technology can give someone so much more independence and access to even knowledge or internet. And that those basic things get denied. So how do you expect someone to live a prosperous and enjoy? Imagine if the internet was not accessible to you or I on a daily basis, just for general connection to our society. You throw COVID-19 on top of that, where everyone's in their house, isolated themselves. You've got a perfect storm for people lining up to die. I don't want to be frank, but you could have a perfect storm where, yeah, people will be shitty and they don't want to live because their life is shitty, not because of their disability, though.
I think that's the real concern here with Bill C-7 is it doesn't consider the precarity of disabled lives. Mm-hmm. It doesn't consider how precarious life can be with disability and the ways in which much of the suffering that we may experience in this world is actually at the hands of the federal government, the provincial government, municipal government, even our own neighbors, right? You know, if we were to lose funding for my electric wheelchair, for instance, or if I were to lose funding for my personal support work, that would fundamentally bankrupt my family. Family would be destitute. And so now I'm left with a choice. Do I continue to live and bankrupt my family, or do I choose death and save my family from the financial burden, from the care burden? That is a horrific decision to ask people to make. But it is exactly the decision that we are setting up disabled people to make. And even more worrisome, the more disabled people that make that decision, the more of us who opt out, the cheaper we suddenly become for those very systems, the federal government, provincial government, municipal government. In many ways, the ableist society benefits from us choosing death. And as we continue to dwindle, it'll be harder and harder to get access to those resources. We're a minority as it is already. And once you start having people make those very difficult choices, those horrific choices that are not based on bodily suffering, that are not based on medical diagnoses, but are purely based because someone in Toronto decided that my ability to elevate my wheelchair to reach a higher shelf was a bonus and not a key part of my life as an independent man, that is a very, very sad state of affairs.
Do you feel that the lens in which this bill was created was primarily based on the medical model versus the social model? So for those who are unaware, the medical model being looking at disability as a flaw within someone and something that needs to be quote unquote corrected versus the social model, which looks at disability as the society in which it exists in. So society choosing whether to install a ramp or not is in fact the issue rather than someone who needs a ramp. So do you feel that the lens in which this creation and all of the potential consequences were hyper-focused on keeping this surrounding issue in the medical model?
I'm not sure if there was necessarily an overt desire.
I don't think there was any consciousness about either the models of that even exist.
Yeah, I think that really this is a reflection of the way in which, while I would say the activist movements to push out the concept of the social model have been remarkably successful in the last 30 years, that at the end of the day, we still live under the hegemony of the medical model. This is a reflection of our society, as opposed to an overt attempt to maintain a status quo.
Yeah, I mean, the wording of the bill very much centers the problem in the body.
Which I think is important to note. For some people, that's accurate.
Yes.
For some people, it is accurate. The issue is that the bill itself and the dialogue, the discourse around the bill presumes that that is the truth for all. And it presumes that if you are not suffering from a biological condition, that you therefore are not suffering and wouldn't make this choice.
That's true.
And that is our major concern.
Yeah, it does explicitly state that for the purposes of the bill, mental illness does not qualify as a disability. And therefore, if your suffering is considered to be as a result of mental distress, then you don't qualify. But but that all presumes that people with disabilities do not also experience suffering based on mental distress, right? Mm-hmm. That like once we have a physical condition, that is the only reason that there's this inextricable link, you know, that suffering is encoded into disability and you can't separate them. And, you know, the social model, as you described, says that's not actually, they're not, it's not innate. It's not inherent in physical disability that we suffer, and that it's so complex. I think the thing is that like human suffering is itself so complex that the idea that it can be compartmentalized to apply in a unique way to a distinct group of people where the fair, ethical, noble, you know, merciful response is a facilitated death is itself philosophically so problematic, because humans experience suffering on a great range regardless of disability, you know? And so this idea that we are in this completely separate category outside of this the spectrum of human experience, it won't reduce stigma against disability. It won't increase inclusion. It won't, you know, bring us into the center of the societies and the communities that we're a part of. It's an act of pushing us and marginalizing us further based on something that we're not claiming for ourselves.
And we need to remember that what this essentially does is it places medical assisted dying within the toolbox of the medical practitioner. So when you are diagnosed now with a disability, this is now essentially a treatment option, so to speak, right? I know we say that it must be about voluntary request, absolutely, but you know, it's part of a doctor's job to lay out all of the potential options, whether it's the medications you could try, whether it's the therapeutics, what types of programs you might be able to access. This is now another program. And you have to wonder, you know, particularly for those who have lived their life in what they think to be normalcy, they believe themselves to be normal, which I say with my tongue deeply embedded within my cheek. Those who then collide with disability, who enter the disabled population later in life, it is a very scary thought. How many of these people who have been told their whole life and presumed their whole life that disability is in and of itself a death sentence, you know, it's the $1 million baby movie all over again. Mm-hmm. How many of those individuals, when they're hearing their treatment options, are going to say, you know what, I don't want to do this treatment stuff. This sounds awful. I don't want to deal with this. This is too stressful. It's upsetting. And frankly, there will not be a solution in my lifetime to the quote unquote problem that I have. And therefore I'm going to make this decision. And what we find is that people who acquire a disability, eventually, you know, with time, you develop an understanding that your life was perhaps, it's not the same, it's different, but that life is still meaningful. It can be meaningful, that there are ways to make these things work. But time is a factor there. And that's a real concern here, is how many people will then make this decision based on essentially faulty information.
Can I chime in on that one, Jeff? Because I think I've got, I'm a person who has an acquired injury, so it's not from birth. I got hurt at 15 years old in a traumatic accident. And I always say, if I rewind it myself 29 years back to that situation, was I suffering at first? You're damn right I was suffering. I mean, I just had a severe spinal cord injury. Breathing was an issue, all the newness of it was. But at that time, if a doctor came before me and said, okay, here's your options, it's what we think your life could look like, or this is what your choice is. But if they had an option to say, okay, you could have a life, but you'll get supported with housing, you'll get supported with employment, you'll get supported with all those things, or you could choose to die because your life will be really shitty. I mean, the way you lay it out on a menu is quite different. And how do you ensure that medical practitioners can even lay out that options? Because right now they can't, because I know for myself, I've had to fight for a lot of those basic things over my 29 years, more than anyone else, but I did. I got through. But I mean, it can all be laid out as a really slippery slope, as I say, especially for those individuals who are new to disability and can be asked that question so early on and after having an accident or being diagnosed with MS being diagnosed with a disability. It's just not the right time to ask.
Well, and I think it's also important to note that there have been studies that have shown doctors are very likely to rate the quality of life of a disabled patient significantly lower than the patient would rate their own quality of life. And on top of that, most disabled people have the experience. I don't know how this works, Kevin, you can speak to this, like through the rehab process, like for an acquired disability, but I know growing up with a disability, doctors were consistently wrong about what I could do, about what was okay for me, about how my body would function. They don't know. And they do everything in these very controlled and sterile environments. And then I take my body out in the world and I throw it around the mountains and I, you know, crawl through the mud and I'm, you know, it's a very different experience. Well, in terms of projecting what possibilities are and, like, you know, what my quality of life will be. And they define it based entirely on what they can see in a very short period of time and not actually on the feedback from disabled people who are living their lives.
Well, and I think an important distinction, and then I'll let Kevin jump in, is that also a lot of those opinions that are driving medical practitioners is based on medical research. And we are, of course, then like, oh, well, it's promoted by research. Of course, it must be true. But of course, much of that research is produced within the medical establishment. And so if you're looking for a certain answer, you will probably find that answer. And so I could agree with Aaron, absolutely. Doctors have tried to kill me off a couple times, told me my death was imminent. And I'm still here, despite. And so
I think that that's a very true thing for a lot of people who have been disabled young, that like our life expectancy, even when the illness or disability we have isn't terminal, is truncated by a social narrative, not actually by medical science. And so many of us have outlived several, this isn't going to last for much longer. This isn't going to last for much longer. And it just sort of, I mean, it's really hard to take the authority of medicine as seriously as it takes itself when you have been written off so many times and then things turned out fine.
I can talk about one of the biggest influences I think that helped me get through my rehab process, I guess, and what's kind of different now, I think. And I can only speak of my process. So this is here in my own personal experience. But what was great back 29 years ago is shortly after I had my accident, I met someone with a similar disability to me, someone who has gone through that transition period, someone who's has experience, has knowledge, you could ask questions to, because those answers are quite a bit different than when you ask doctors or medical professionals who aren't disabled those questions. And fast forward now, and I see a huge gap in those types of supports with funding. Whenever there's a peer support program, it's like, well, what's that going to really do? But I see firsthand when people talk to people, not only do they get more hope maybe or feel that's not going to be that bad, or get a glimpse that it might be bad, but it's not the end of the world, to the point where it just made all the difference for me. And I think if we can continue to get people talking about disability and not as a scary thing, then those attitudes hopefully will change. But as Jeff said, he's been fighting this for how long? I've been going through these ableism. I mean, I just learned what ableism was 2 years ago, but now that I know the definition, I'm more familiar with it. I've lived in an ableist society my whole 29 years. I just wasn't aware of it. And that's quite open and frank, but now I notice those things more. I'm like, wow, I used to just accept that because that's what I thought. And that's kind of weird to say that out loud, but it's the truth.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Kevin, you're touching on something I think that's really a huge factor in the precariousness that Jeff mentioned earlier, which is that we're often very isolated from each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I hear stories of newly injured people, and it was spinal cord injury specifically, because I'm in with that community, and not even knowing what supports are available or not given that information and assuming so many things that the only way you'll be successful is if you have 24-hour care. And the only way you can get that is if you live in a nursing home. If someone told you that and you don't know if there's a choice or there's another alternative, well, that's going to be pretty depressing, I think. So it's so many things how if you talk to people who live it, first voice, I call it, and this is where the government failed once again. And I work for the provincial government, so I can speak very frankly, is not asking first voice people to make these decisions. It's that simple. Ask the people who it affects. And that can just not go with disability. That can go with any variety of things. Aboriginal, gay, lesbian community. Just ask the people who it affects and you'll get the true answer.
The problem with Bill C-7 is that Bill C-7 really actually should be one of the last measures that the federal government puts into place for disabled people. And instead, it's actually going to be one of the first.
Yeah,
we are implementing this before we've tackled any of these other complex barriers that do lead to legitimate suffering for disabled people on a day-to-day basis. This shouldn't be the first thing we're doing. This should be the last thing we're doing.
And we've heard such heartbreaking stories that have come out of this where cases of people who've gone through with a suicide because they can't get that 2 extra hours of attendant care that they need to live independently in their home. And their only choice is to move 4 hours away from their family to a long-term care institution. Like, these are the choices that people are having to make. And that's the disabling thing with this whole thing. It really comes down to that. So those are just little examples, but it's good to point those out. These are small things to some people's mind, but it's massive in the people who actually live it.
I think something also that Kevin is touching on is that a lot that I think non-disabled people don't quite register is that a lot of the options that we're given or the things that we're told, like, you know, Kevin, you were saying how, like, if somebody just says to you, well, the only option is you need this 24-hour care and you're never going to be able to do these things on your own and et cetera, et cetera. A lot of that comes from non-disabled people making decisions based on what they think will be better for them.
Yeah.
And what will make it easier for them to tolerate us, you know, like wheelchairs that are designed for the comfort of a caretaker or a pusher, and not at all in consideration of how a disabled person might move it around themselves. And, like, you know, and just a lot of interactions that we have where we are moved and positioned and set up based on the preferences, the comfort of the non-disabled people that we'll be interacting with. And to some, like, ridiculously paternalistic degrees, because in some cases they've just assumed a dependency that doesn't exist and then tried to mitigate that dependency, you know, by creating all of these obstacles, even though they weren't going to ever be needed in the first place. And so I think when we're already dealing with this constant effort that it takes to exercise agency, you know, our autonomy does not come effortlessly. We fight for it on a regular basis, that to then call a bill that funnels us toward death an act of, like, respecting our autonomy, you know, the contradiction of that is, I think, really hard for us to reconcile with and to accept and to trust, you know, that, oh yeah, sure, all the safety measures, we're going to make sure there are safety measures. And yeah, we do really believe that it's important that we fund, you know, social supports. Yeah. But it's all, those are all things that they can just say to sound reassuring. This is a bill that's being rushed into law. Mm-hmm. It's not just being talked about. They're really steamrolling it forward very quickly.
In a world in which not every province or territory in Canada has an accessibility law, those who do have accessibility laws are failing regularly to meet benchmarks for those accessibility laws, in which Canadians lose their access to benefits if they move from one country to another, in which the rules that I have to follow to access accessible vehicles in Ontario are radically different than the rules to access accessible vehicles in Quebec. In fact, it is easier for me to be a driver in Ontario than it is in Quebec. But the system is fundamentally broken. And so, like, my apologies if I trust very little in any statement that the federal and provincial governments will magically, after this bill is passed, suddenly resolve all of the problems facing disabled people.
I think also, like, corollary to that, Jeff, is that like, we also have concrete evidence that the bill that's already in place of C-14 has not been monitored appropriately, mm-hmm. that there are huge gaps in the distribution of, like, so we collect a certain amount of data, but then who's responsible for that information? Is the province or the federal government? That is unclear. There were a couple of, I think maybe two out of the number of assisted deaths where they did not follow the protocol, the steps that were required by law before administering MAID to somebody, which would make that a breach of the criminal code. Mm-hmm. But who enforces that? What law, you know, like, is it the local police that you call and say, hey, we need to do an investigation because there may have been a murder? Or is it the federal government? That's not specified either. And so there's already these huge gaps in their administering MAID.
According to a report published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal in 2017, doctor-assisted death could reduce the annual healthcare spending across the country between $34.7 million and $136.8 million.
Point is, there's a lot of money that's been saved and a high ratio of deaths.
According to a Globe and Mail article published in 2019, approximately 1 in 50 deaths in the country is attributed to assisted suicide.
And not an equivalent ratio of data on how the process was followed and whether or not the protocol that was in place was followed. And in the cases where it wasn't followed, there was no repercussions to that. And so we already aren't using the law we currently have in a way that is ethical or even legal, and certainly not organized. And so it isn't ready to be amended. You know, it hasn't been studied properly yet. We haven't collected the data that we need about, you know, how this is playing out. And we definitely have stories of people saying on the record that they are making this choice because they were failed by their government. There were other options available to them that they wanted and were refused. And this was the last resort for them, but it wasn't what they wanted. So, you know, there are a lot of, like, philosophical concerns that we have, but there's also these very tangible, like, this, you're already not doing it well. Why do you want more freedom and more flexibility to do it in higher numbers when this is already not something that's being, you know, managed safely?
So it's about 7,000 that have died. The earliest that I can find is in April of 2019. I can't find anything based in 2020 for a total, just projections. So they haven't officially released how many people so far have died from MAID, which is, of course, concerning. So according to the Department of Justice's website on Bill C-7, quote, people with disabilities that seek out medical assistance dying must make a voluntary request for MAID that is not the result of external pressure and must give informed consent. Do you feel that the measures proposed by the government so far ensure that there's no external influence? And how does the influence of, like, a greater ableist society impact someone's decision to potentially go forward with medical assistance death while they are disabled?
When I wrote to Senator Petitclerc, when this was shunted to the Senate, I told her a story about when I was five in kindergarten. And I wanted to take gymnastics class and I wanted to be in the school play, and we would have gym. This was like I think it was maybe a snow day. There was some reason why all the kids were just running around like nutsos in the gym. And I was playing. I had, you know, like, leg braces up to my hips and, you know, crutches and plastic everywhere and metal and hinges. And I was collapsing and clattering all over my classmates. And my mom says that the principal was watching from the door where she had come to, like, pick me up, and said to her, you know, someday someone is going to have to tell her she's disabled. And this is, like, a man of authority telling my mother that, like, my happiness would be fleeting and that I needed to be prepared and given a realistic expectation of what my life would be in the future. And that, you know, as far as he was concerned, it would definitely be suffering and pointlessness. And what's interesting to me about that is, in order to say someone's going to have to tell her he's disabled, to some extent he knew it wasn't intrinsic to me. If you have to tell me then it isn't like it's not innate. If I would never figure it out if you didn't tell me, then it isn't really me at all in the first place. And so the idea that like our lie, I was primed to suffer. You know, people were not subtle about it, that there was no hope. You know, they'll say a common thing that I would hear from a young age, people going out of their way to say to me, it's such a shame, you're so beautiful, because nobody will want you. And this is like, you know, why are people saying these things? This is a reality they've now created that didn't exist before they opened their mouths and told me, you know, that that's how I'm being perceived by people. And so, you know, while it's not the job of a legal bill, you know, for the criminal code to address people who say mean things to us, although it would be nice, I think that the idea that that pressure somehow, it's so, it's etheric. It is around us all the time. We are being, you know, pressured when we leave our house to do very basic things. And, you know, I think to not acknowledge that that is also in the minds of doctors, is also in the minds of, you know, nurses taking care of us, health, you know, other healthcare practitioners. I don't know that there is a way to adequately say, yes, we have prevented there being external pressure, you know, on your decision, when that's still what we're experiencing on a regular basis.
I think the way that the bill is written and the way that I've heard it spoken about, it seems to be really focused in on this idea that, you know, that like my partner shouldn't be forcing me overtly into this and being like, this is the right thing for you, husband, go and do it. But I think that it completely misses what I believe constitutes the actual external pressure that many of us face. I think, you know, echoing what Aaron has shared, was it external pressure when I was applying to university? I had a university in Ontario refuse to tour me on campus because they said, campus is not accessible for someone like you. You should go to Carleton because that's the accessible school in Ontario. Is that external pressure? Like, was it external pressure when my wheelchair broke down and I was told that it would be 8 to 12 months before I could get access to a chair that did not cause constant pain every day? Was it external pressure when I was handing out resumes and it took over 100 resumes before I was hired for my first job, a job that I received because the person hiring for the job happened to know me from the hospital in which I had gone as a child? Are any of these things external pressure? Does this constitute external pressure? Because I would argue, find me a disabled person who has not been pressured by this society to see themselves as being less valuable or devalued. Yeah, an obstruction, a burden upon everyone around them. I find it very difficult to imagine.
Yeah, and I think this, it is very irresponsible to not consider that an external pressure.
The bill also mentions a 90-day assessment period. So after the initial request, there would be 90 days in which, like, the assessing physician would monitor, see if this is still what the person requesting MAID wants to go through with in order to see whether this is actually, like, a viable plan for them. So what are the flaws in this probationary period?
Well, I think, you know, going off what I just said, I find me a program, a therapeutic or equipment funding program in Canada that has a waiting period shorter than 90 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it doesn't exist, or very, very few of them anyways. You know, 90 days in Ontario, we've been working on the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act since 2005. and I still can't get into most places. You know, like the federal government has just started trying to work on an Accessible Canada Act, which, by the way, only affects federal government and doesn't really translate anywhere else. Now, of course, we have like a bit of a federalism province issue going on there, but the journey to making a world that is both accepting and accessible equitably for disabled people is not 90 days away. It's probably not even 100 years away.
That was part one of our two-part series interviewing participants of the Why Us campaign. Stay tuned for next week's continuation, airing Wednesday at 5 p.m. Up now is the song Falling in Between Days by the band Margo.
COVID-19. We must all continue to respect public health guidelines and follow self-isolation instructions. Self-isolate if you have symptoms. Self-isolate after testing. Self-isolate if the test is positive. Self-isolate when you return from a trip. And self-isolate when you've been in contact with someone who's tested positive. Self-isolation is important. Please, take it seriously. Learn more at quebec.ca/self-isolating. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to the first part of an interview series with participants of the Why Us campaign. If you would like more information on the Why Us campaign, you can look them up on Facebook. Why Us by Project Value. That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, you can check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you'd like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalancheckut.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news at ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Hersey. That's up next. We'll be right back.
following is a previously broadcast program.
Hey, you. Come over here and listen.
Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Yeah. Yeah. Like that. Like that. Oh, God.
You can't hear me.
I would love your cop to be inside me. Oh, God, I'm really gonna come. I'm really gonna come. Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Can you see how wet I am? Can you see how wet I am? Oh, fuck. Yeah. 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 Oh, fuck.
It's time for Audio Smut. It's time for Audio Smut. Smut, smut, smut,
smut, smut, smut.
A queer, feminist, trans positive radio show about fucking in all its forms.
Four, five fingers.
Let's not beat around the bush. This show contains explicit sexual content. So turn the volume all the way up.